I think Hawkwood is special because it's in the most wonderful location, you know, and the weather, it comes up the Bristol Channel, winds and wet, but it's gentle weather on the whole. The house is a house that grew. We know that there was an older foundation under the stables, and then the house grew and it was redeveloped, and then as needs grew, it grew, and I think the last thing to be built was the classroom, wasn't it? The hall. And as you go through the rooms, you get that feeling, don't you, that this is the kitchen, it's been here a long time. These are the rooms that were built in front. This was the formal dining room, you know, this was the drawing room. And then you get the feeling as you go out of the back, these were the rooms that were divided in two when they had students here. So it's got this wonderful history. And when we had the Betjeman Society, we had the son of Colonel Capel, the Capels had lived here quite a long time, and they're integrated with local history. They were linked with the 17th and 18th century woolen trade. So this was a wool merchant's home, basically. Which brings us on not only to the location, but I think water is terribly important. I mean, it was important for the evolution of that woolen trade, really, with the mills. And it also brings something special to Hawkwood, doesn't it? The spring, and then the water feature that's been put in, which sort of augments that. It was founded was given the name Hawkwood by Colonel Murray, who bought the estate from Colonel Capel in 1936. Now, when we had the Betjeman course here, and I think it's about 10 years ago, at least 10 years ago, we had a stranger in our midst, and then he admitted that he was the grandson of Colonel Capel, who'd lived here, and told us that, according to his mother, Capel hadn't been a terribly good landlord. People in the village talked about him, and one chap, I've been trying to think of his surname, John, said, probably in the mid-1920s, as a schoolboy, he'd been mooching around in the woods, probably birds nesting or something, and Colonel Capel came along with a rifle over his shoulder and took him by the ear and said, "If I ever find you in my woods again, I'll shoot you." And John said he didn't ever come back again. And so in those days, Hawkwood belonged to the gentry, and unless you worked here, you didn't infiltrate it. And this house belonged to sort of gardeners and people. And initially it was just that room, and then they built this room on. And then they built that room. So that's an external wall. And so is that. And that used to be the front door sort of thing. So, you know, this is the little house. But this little house has connections with the village and the town. So the big house always looked towards Painswick. Mm. They went to Painswick to church. And that's where people with whom they socialise live.
Apparently, Hawkwood, when it was known as The Grove, which was before it was called Hawkwood, even before the Capels,
yes,
was a hermitage for Prinish Abbey people to come to The Grove for respite. And we don't know what sort of form or home house it was, but it was...
There's quite a lot in the archives in Gloucester, in the Gloucester archives, because when our daughter was doing A-level, she had to do a thing on changing land use. Mm. So she used Mum to be her researcher. Mm. Mum went off very willingly. And Capel, who sold The Grove in 1936, his grandfather kept quite a good diary. Mm. And the grandfather's mother went to live at the Coles when she was widowed. Mm. So do you see, there was quite, you know, all of this area looking towards Painswick, basically. And he kept a very interesting diary about driving. He would drive over to Cirencester for dinner, which we thought was about 4 a.m. in the afternoon, which seems to fit in with the local patterns. But he's so interesting. I mean, can you believe it? He was taken to Cheltenham to catch the 11 o'clock coach. No, the early morning coach, I think it was. And he arrived in Manchester 13 hours later, thanks to the poles, the tolls and the new roads. And he writes with the liveliness. Yeah. And some of the diary is missing, but bits of it are absolutely fascinating. Mm. And you get a feeling for the Ricardos, you know, and the people who were living at Stratford Mill. So I've got a sort of jigsaw puzzle mind because I belong to the local history society, you know, and we get speakers who are terribly keen on Stratford Mill, and then 3 years later somebody comes and talks about something else. Mm. But the people living here were very much part of that society. And although I say they didn't socialise with Stroud, I mean, they belonged to a small group of people. The Capels contributed to the subrooms, which was 100 guineas to be a subscriber, and they certainly had their name on when the hospital was founded in 1853 or somewhere like that. So do you know, they, and I think they were involved with Marling Grammar School. So they were looked on as beneficiaries, but for their social lives, they tended to go to Painswick or Gloucester and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So I think the foundation, Mrs. Wincot, Margaret Wincot was her name, but she liked to be called Jill.
No, she's Lily Wincot.
She's Lily. It's Margaret Bunnell. Mm. But she liked to be, she was Lily, but she liked to be called Jill.
Right.
She was the daughter, and I can't think of his first name, of a man called Norton, who was half Scots, who made a fortune in the First World War with the Norton motorbikes, which were used by the dispatch riders. Mm. And her mother died when she was relatively young. And so she became, I think at the age of 17, the hostess for her father when he was entertaining other industrialists. So, you know, she had a good feeling of housekeeping. She was genial. And Eileen Cookson had met her and told me quite a bit about her. On the other hand, her granddaughter also told, I'm sure she told you about Granny. Mm. She was married to Mr. Jeffries and had two sons. They were Quakers. She felt, I think, in life she would like to do something very positive. And she had a grandmother who was, you know, Mennonite, Stoke Amish. I think her marriage to Mr. Jeffries was okay. She had two sons. And then her husband had a massive stroke but didn't die. And she had met Roland Wincot at a sort of conference that she'd been at. I think as a Quaker, she'd been searching. But this is the thing I read and hear about her. She'd been searching for something like that. After the war, they were able to travel more and went to Winston's to a significant conference. For a while, they lived together as a ménage à trois with husband badly, you know, having had the stroke. I don't know whether he could speak, but I think he was bedridden. And then she and Roland. And the sons took this rather badly, particularly one of them. Mm. One of the sons had married in Alexandria and then died, leaving his daughter, who came to live in the lodge.
What happened then? Because I thought, so did the disabled husband die eventually?
The disabled husband died,
right.
And 6 months after his death, she and Roland married. And I think this caused... talking to people, I think this caused a bit of a furore because, you know, a ménage à trois at that time and then marrying 6 months later. They didn't expect someone like Lily to do that, which she had.
She was a wild spirit, obviously.
Yeah, some of the family thought that he was a bit of a gold digger. But judging from their actions and the things they did... I think she looked on him as the love of her life, really. Mm. And they wanted to do something special. And they went, I think it was after the war, they went to a conference at Winston's and were hearing about the Winstonian teachers, the Steiner teachers, who were committed to a class, you know, as it went up through several years and got terribly tired because, I mean, they were taking such a broad range of curriculum that they were teaching. And she felt she'd like to do something for the teachers, and she'd also like to help artists. And she and Roland were looking for a sort of large house where they could do some of these things, and also, I don't know whether she would have said retire in style, but that's the sort of feeling it's you get about them. And they were told about Hawkwood. They went to several houses, and then they were told that whilst they were at Winston's, this conference, Hawkwood was on the market, because in 1936, Colonel Capel, I'm sorry I'm not doing this in a more logical stream, but in 1936, Colonel Capel sold it to Colonel Murray, and Murray lived here until the end of the war, to 1947, and the lady who taught our daughter went to a little dancing school in Stroud Academy of Dancing, had come up to what she called the ballroom, which was the Colonel Capel's billiard room that had been turned into a ballroom for Murray's children. And she had taught them dancing. So she was able to tell me quite a lot about the Murray children, which was very interesting. However, by the end of the war, I don't know what Murray's finances were, but he decided to go and live in the West Indies. And it was he who had changed the name from the Grove to Hawkwood because of his admiration for the Admiral, which is something I didn't know until quite recently.
Sir John Hawkwood.
Yes.
He was a mercenary, a military man. I think he fought on behalf of the Italians. His name was John Hawkwood, so although it seems like it would be named for the buzzards, it isn't.
But it was actually after an admiral or somebody, yes.
I think he was a soldier.
And what was terribly interesting, during Tony's time, I did an awful lot of on-duty. And I was on duty down there one Saturday, you know, doing what you do, welcoming people. And the most delightful couple came. And they were his children, and they were on holiday from the West Indies. They were grandfathers. No, they were his grandchildren. And they'd heard about Hawkwood and wanted to take photos, and did we mind if they photographed the hall and with this, that and the other. And they said, yes, he had to go to the West Indies, really, because after the war, the cost of living was escalating, and I think he'd got property in the West Indies or something. But it was so nice to meet someone relating to that family. You know, it made it feel more real sort of thing. And I don't think Colonel Murray was as tough on dog walkers and people coming into the... as the Capel had been, yes. So the story goes that Lily and Roland... moved in, and there's quite a moving account that I think was written by Margaret Bunnell about how they stood in the window of what was then the drawing room, which is now the library, looking out at the sun going down over the escarpment, and saying how terribly happy they were. And he had a massive stroke, and I think he was taken to the Falcon Hotel because they hadn't quite moved in, and he actually died there. It was Clear's Roberta's father, who died in Alexandria, and he had married an English Jewish woman, and they were allowed to live in the lodge on sufferance. And it was pretty primitive in those days, I think. You know, with a well and not much heating. And Granny lived in style, and she was allowed to come up and have a bath in Granny's bathroom once a week. And not to make a mess.
Let's talk about
Hawkwood.
So Roland had this massive stroke.
He died.
Tragic.
And I can't think who it was. Someone in the old anthroposophical group said that there was tremendous legal things about his will, because apparently it was written on a piece of paper and some people didn't think it was authentic, so on and so forth. But on the positive side, he died, and then on Princess Elizabeth's wedding day in November 1947, when I had a holiday from school, we all had a holiday from school, Margaret Bunnell, who was teaching at Winston's, rode up on her bicycle to come and commiserate, really, with the newly widowed Mrs. Wincott. Now, Margaret Bunnell is worth Googling because she was an early British anthroposophist, and she'd encountered Steiner education when she was quite young, and she was really a progressive in terms of education, and she'd helped to found Winston School, with George Turner, who was one of Bernard's trustees. I never met her, but she published a book. One of the German students told me she'd published a book. Again, she's worth Googling, with Isabel Wyatt, and it's something about Shakespeare. But Margaret Bunnell is, because I think she, okay, Lily had the money and so on and so forth, but in terms of the educational spark, it almost goes from Margaret Bunnell to Bernard, possibly to Alicia. I think that's how I would put it at the moment.
She's certainly got inspiration.
And she's got all the contacts that she had at Dartington and the systems that she understands.
That's true. The Dartington factor is interesting because I feel like Alicia brought Dartington in and I brought Findhorn in.
Yes.
And they kind of came in about the same sort of time because she came in 2011 and I was already had Findhorn in me, but it wasn't, didn't have permission away. And in 2014, then I live streamed a conference from Findhorn and it like opened up a portal, I feel, for that energy. And then her...
I mean, your input was very strong, really. My mother-in-law went and took herself off to Findhorn when we got married because her bachelor son didn't need her anymore. So we didn't go with all the rest of the family. We came to Gloucestershire to do our own thing. That's what she told us to do, so we did it. Margaret Bunnell, whom I didn't meet, Bernard, whom I knew quite well. In fact, I was still visiting him in our home not long before he died. But between those people, of course, there were torch holders. Katie's one of them, you know. In 1947, Margaret Bunnell came up to console Margaret, whom she may well have... Lily Wincop. Margaret came on her bicycle. I can just see it, can't you? You've been down to Winston School.
Yeah.
Riding on a bicycle in November to come up here. And they sat by the fire, and they probably met, you see, at Winston conferences and things. And Lily said, well, I have a house, and Margaret had got an idea, really, for what we would call a gap year. And it was particularly poignant at that time because Europe had been at war. And you know, young people have had a heck of a time. I think particularly some of the Germans in, you know, Berlin and places like that, the bigger urban areas. And so they started Hawkwood, I think, in 1948. What I find interesting, I think they had very little at that time. And certainly when I first became involved with Hawkwood, they had beds that the army had used, you know, little flat, low ones, with a reasonable mattress and some springs in it. And I was told that when the students first came in, they slept upstairs on the second, well, if you say the ground floor, the first floor, the second floor. And where the carpet stopped, that was their area.
And were they boarding? Were they boarding?
They were boarding, students? Yes, they were boarding students. I think many of them had come via the Steiner School recommendation. Now, the Steiner Schools were taboo in Nazi times. I think they had a very difficult time. And I've just been watching something on television about Prince Philip by the royal family, and it shows pictures of Kurt Hein's school in Germany, and with the swastika flying on the flag, and he couldn't cope with it, so that's when he came and started Gordonston. And running at the same time as this were the Quakers in the Five Valleys, and the Five Valleys have got quite a strong tradition of nonconformalism. I think it's because there was never a massive landowner, you know, and you've got the industry, the woolen industry, the spinning, the weaving, the textiles, the dyeing, the fulling, the whole range happening. So there was quite a lot of, this was an industrial area, somewhat different to the North Cotswolds, which are rather more rural. And we certainly know that John Wesley stood in the shambles. The shambles are down just in front of the church, and there's a board up there saying he leapt up onto a butcher's decking at some point and preached. And there are early Quaker rooms. There's one in Painswick that's quite old. There's quite an old one in Nailsworth. So you've got this sturdy nonconformalism coming through. So in the 30s, the Quakers There were Germans coming to Britain anyway. I'm not quite sure. I think Dr. Glass and his wife came and they founded, Margaret Bunnell founded Winston's in 1935 as a Steiner school because of what was happening in Nazi Germany. So it became a bit of a focal point for anthroposophists from Germany, but also German speakers.
Yeah.
And the local Quakers were terribly worried about the children and very supportive of the Kinder transport. And in about 1972 or three, I was helping at Hawkwood, and I'll explain, I wasn't living here, but I was helping. And I met a German teacher from a Steiner school called Magda Meyer. I think she has died, and I'm awfully sorry, I can't remember which city she taught in. But she was a wonderful woman, quite statuesque, single. Her father had been a Lutheran and the mayor of their town. Mother was Jewish, and they could see what was happening, so he wanted to get his wife, Magda, and the little boy, George, out, and they came on the Kinder train. It makes me have goose pimples. I think she said on the 28th of August 1939 they got here, and she arrived in this area without a word of English with her little brother, and they went to school at Winston's, and it was easy because there were enough German speaking people, and they lived in a family. I'm trying to think of the village. It's very hilly. It's the other side of Painswick. But you can imagine they were in a little isolated, and everybody made them welcome. And she learned English very quickly and became a very good linguist. She went back after the war and to Germany and became a teacher, a teacher training for Steiner teachers. And she used to bring a group of Steiner teachers over every summer to Hawkwood. They'd do a three-week refresher course, which Bernard and Eileen ran, and it was to integrate them back into English society of the time. So they would have, you know, the Times, the Telegraph, the Daily Mirror, and the Star to read, and the Stroud News and Journal. They'd listen to television. They'd go to Stratford and see at least one play. They'd find out what was happening in Gloucester, you know, and they'd have local people coming in talking about life as it was in England and what was happening. This coexisted with the language school, and I'll come back to that later. But Magda, I always remember the first time I saw the choir, because I was teaching a craft class at the time, and there were these rather serious, upstanding German teachers, and I could see them through the glass window singing, and they would be singing English folk songs. And on this occasion, they were singing, "Oh, no, John, no, John, no, John, you know, will you do this? And will you stay an old maid forever?" And they were all standing there, "No, John, no, John, no, John." And I remember at the meal, I said, "I think you should smile when you get to that one." And Magda was conducting them. And I knew her quite well. And she was a delight. She was the same age as my mother, I suppose. But no, she wasn't. No, she was probably only 5 or 6 years older than me. Because I was born in 1934, and I remember the outbreak of war, because we lived at Deal and had to move, you know, in case there was an invasion. So I think she was 10, and I think her brother George was about my age. Well, this was by 19... They were doing this in 1970s, you see. These English teachers... I mean, yeah. She was mature by then, and of course Bernard... I'll come back to Bernard in a minute. Shall I try to be logical? Lily Wincop and Margaret Bunnell started the sort of gap year, and I think the students did get a chance to go to Stratford-on-Avon and read the newspapers, probably not the Daily Star, and once a week they were allowed into what is now the library, where Mrs. Wincop had her pink carpets and her very nice, some of the furniture still there, but otherwise they were in the other room, which was relatively Spartan, you know, in a way, with simple armchairs, but not the type you could roll back in. And then they lived on the top floor. And again, when I was helping at Hawkwood at one period, more than one occasion, middle-aged, rather portly Germans would come and say, I was a student here in 1950 or something. And they'd tell us about it, and they'd say, you know, I grew up in Berlin, I didn't think we'd be alive, or half the family is dead or something, do you know? Stuttgart, I think, is where Magda came from. And what it meant to come to this peaceful English valley with Mrs. Wynkop, who was the gracious lady of the house, you know, and I think was very good at housekeeping. I think she would make cakes and things on occasion, and then they'd be invited into the drawing room. They had a stimulating curriculum, not overly intellectual, but, you know, I think to help them think about world peace and all sorts of things. And then they did lots of craft. They did painting. They did metalwork, I think, where you pricked metal, you know, and made patterns on it. And they learnt to spin, because that's what Elizabeth Bruce Smith taught them to use a spinning wheel, and I think they knitted. And I don't know what else they did, but it was quite integrated in terms of craft and so on and so forth. But these Germans, these mature people coming back, would say, do you know, it was so peaceful. The food was lovely. Well, the food wasn't lovely in 1950. I remember it. But if you lived in the country,
yeah,
you know, there was meat. There were lovely vegetables, and we ate seasonally. Mm. You know, so here gooseberries, and well, you didn't have strawberries in November, but you know, and you made blackberry jam, sort of thing. Yeah. So for them, I can see it must have been lovely, and they felt nurtured, and often went back into all sorts of things. And I think the chap that I remember most had actually gone back into industry or something. And he looked very prosperous and very well fed, actually. But you got this feeling that for most of them it had been very meaningful. So this was the era of Margaret Bunnell and Lily Wynkop from about 1948 to about 1958. And I think maybe 57, Mrs. Wynkop died. And I think Margaret had possibly left at that stage, but Benedict Wood, who'd been a teacher at Winston's, came and took it on with another lady whose name I've forgotten. And I think they tried to keep the whole thing going. And they were getting students from all over Europe, you know, France, and not behind the Iron Curtain, obviously, but... And it was becoming more difficult because the students were becoming a bit more ambitious about what they wanted. And the... I think Mrs. Wynkop's money wasn't there. At the time of her death, and this has come from Bernard, so it's obviously a bit one-sided, the sons, she said she had left the property, and I can't remember the wording, but it was slightly ambiguous, to the Anthroposophical Society of Gloucestershire or something. And I'm sorry, I may be misinterpreting it, but that's the general gist of it. And I think the family felt that, you know, mother had inherited a great deal from the Norton Michael motorbikes. One son had died, and the other members of the family felt it was time they had a bit of mother's inheritance, really. And so they sold a lot of the wood in the trees, and I think it was mature wood that would have been worth quite a bit, probably. Other things were sold that had belonged to her, because even after her death, when I first came, there were little bits of china and silver spoons in alcoves that have all disappeared since then. And the place, I don't like to say it was going downhill, but I think that's the feeling that I got, really, that the money wasn't there, the students were wanting something a bit different. The place was getting overgrown because they hadn't got that many staff. And that's when Bernard Cookson and his second wife, Eileen, they were invited to take it over, which they did with great alacrity. And Eileen had been a pupil at Winston's school. Her parents had helped to set it up. Her father was a local solicitor. And they had met and fallen in love when her mother was taking in paying guests at a very nice home, their home in Bristol, and Bernard was at the university in Bristol. And so they felt they were ready to come. Bernard was probably, I'm trying to think of his age in relationship to my own and my father's. I would think Bernard may well have been born just after the First World War. His father was an architect, quite creative. His mother died when he was quite young, and he had a little brother called Norman. And he went as a youngster to, I think it was a Steiner school, it was a primary school, and there was a teacher there who was like his second mother. In fact, you know, he looked on her as his mother. And he felt he had to look after his little brother to a certain extent. I don't think it was a terribly happy childhood in many ways. I may have his age all wrong, because he was a student in Germany at the outbreak of war, so he would have been born at least by 1920. Well, maybe I'm not too, not me, I'm not too, but he was very bright, very intellectual, and a much gentler person than you would probably think. He was rather shy, so he came over sometimes as being rather jocular, ha ha ha, but actually he was delightful, incredibly well read. And he was doing studies on Goethe, and in the end he finally published a translation of Goethe's work and commentary on it, but it didn't happen for sort of 25 years after he'd been at Hawkwood, thanks to his third wife. Because Eileen, wife number one, died, and wife number one was, well, I'll tell you about wife number one. He went off to Germany as a student. I think he was studying Goethe. I'm not sure where he was based. With the outbreak of war, he and other students went to Sweden, and he worked in the garden of the King of Sweden, growing vegetables and learning Swedish, and I think continuing with his studies to a certain degree. He's a very good linguist. He had, obviously, Latin,
yeah.
But he had French, German, Swedish. I mean, yeah, incredible, really. And whilst he was there, he met Margaret, and they were both young, and they fell in love, and they married, and they had two lovely children, very blonde children. Christian, who likes to be called Bill, and Anna Marie, who went to live in Australia eventually. And coming back to England, I mean, she adapted quite well, but he was going on with his studies. He wanted to do a PhD, and I think it didn't gel as a marriage. You know, and when you think about it, with the war and everything and the change of country and so on and so forth. So he was, I don't know whether they were divorced or what, but he was living in Mrs. Brooking, Eileen's mother's house in Bristol. And Eileen's sister, somewhat older than Eileen, was an actress and had worked for the BBC, Angela Booking, I think that was her name. She worked for the BBC doing stories and reading. And she also worked at St. Christopher's, which was a Steiner school for children with learning difficulties, and was terribly interested in nurturing and seeing what people could do rather than categorising children, saying, they can't do this, they need to be in a home, do you know? I think they were very sensitive to the potential. I mean, we take it sort of for granted now, but in the post-war era, it was very different, you know, and children with learning difficulties often got sort of incarcerated in psychiatric hospitals with no education until the Education Act came along. So, and Eileen was particularly interested in helping her sister to do music, because she was very musical, with children at St. Christopher's. And she was also a very talented artist and was working, she met Bernard. Well, he was living at her mother's, as she was, and she took herself off to Edinburgh and worked with a theatre group designing stage scenery and things, because she had a wonderful sense, you know, and she had the confidence of a good artist,
yeah.
You know, how they can conceptualise something and go with it. But her love for Bernard was very great, and eventually they did get together, but had a relatively good relationship with wife and children, relatively good. So I met Bernard and Eileen in the summer of 1969, and James and I married that autumn, and we went down to see them 6 months after we were married here, because that's where they were coming. And we were met at the front door by Eileen's mother, Mrs. Brooking, who said, "We're so glad you've come, but Bernard's not at all well. He's had a heart attack. There was so much that needed to be done here. And he's an architect's son, you know, so he could envisage how to do this and do the other. And he'd just gone at painting and decorating and humping and all the worry about how they were going to move on. And he'd had this heart attack and he was in a very bad way. And the whole estate was in rather a bad way because it was a bit overgrown. Benedict Wood was still there, and a linchpin, one of these carriers, you know, who'd carried her from the old thing, rather as Katie has been in some respects. We visited him in his study. He was also a smoker, which didn't help. And Eileen was running the place. Now, at that time, they were continuing English as a second language, because they'd taken over, so they still had students from Europe. They beefed up the curriculum a little bit. And Eileen, of course, could do a fantastic input, because she and Bernard were great art historians. She particularly, you see. And he would do the historical background, and she could do the art. And so that, and at weekends and in college holidays, they put on courses of people. Perhaps they'd do a Shakespeare weekend, or they'd have somebody from the Birmingham Philharmonic come and do something, discuss a symphony, and they'd have somebody, they had concerts and invited those of us living nearby to pop in and see them. But they were terribly worried. Mrs. Brooking had gone to live in the lodge, which was empty at that time, so they were getting a rent from her. And they said, "We're just going to have to sell property." And they offered us to come here, and because I'd helped once or twice with craft courses, and I'm not particularly artistic, but I could enamel. I'd had a next-door neighbour who showed me how to do small enamelling, yeah. So I did that for sort of free for their summer schools. And they said, "Would we like to come and rent this house," which consisted of that room, this room, and that room at the time. And we thought about it, and we just bought our first home in London, which was very small, in Blackheath. But James was quite taken with being here. I loved it, because, of course, I was a country person, and I was very fond of Eileen, too. And after a lot of humming and hurrying, we said, "Well, no, we wouldn't mind buying it, but not to rent it." And in the end, they sold it to us, because they needed that capital to put an injection in. And then we suddenly realised what we'd taken on, because there was no road access at the time. The lady who'd been here before had parked up in the field at the far end, and they just went up and down this steep path. But I mean, we were young at that point, but we did have a son with cerebral palsy that we used to have to carry in a rucksack on our back. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, we did come here. We moved in 76. And the following year, Eileen was quite ill. She and Bernard worked so beautifully together. You know, you sometimes see that partnership that is pure joy. I mean, there are partnerships that are good and then some that are pure joy. And anyway, Eileen was ill. She had a brain tumour, a neuroblastoma. She was in Bristol Hospital for a bit and she came home. By this time, Bernard had got his brother, Norman, the one he'd always looked after. Norman and Norman's daughter were living at the lodge. Norman's wife hadn't been able to look after their daughter. And their daughter was adopted, as was our Michael. And then we had a Katie too, that we adopted both. So the children got on terribly well together and used to play on the lawn. This place was very overgrown and we built bits on the other side, you know. But it was nice, so we all got on very well together. But Eileen was dying and I spent a lot of time with her. I used to do the night shift and her sister did the day shift. And I was with her when she died. And so I got to know a closeness with her and also with Bernard. And it's difficult really to say, just thinking about Bernard, he was very intellectual. He was working on a PhD, but he'd had to rather drop it because coming to Hawkwood. But in spite of all their problems, they were terribly happy together and they created, he could see the potential for, you know, when you cross the courtyard from the office, there's a door and a toilet just on the right. There was just a toilet and no door.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, if we could have an entrance there as well as the one to the dining room. And his brother, who worked for the Minna Bag and was down in the little room down there with his daughter going to the Winstonster school, said, brother will do it. And brother did it, of course. You know, he was known as the Cornish craftsman because he lived in Cornwall. It was that sort of wonderful cooperation. And to see this thing emerging, and Bernard would have some weekend courses, but also, as I say, the holiday courses. In the summer, he would have students. At that point, they were still having the residential students doing English as a second language. But he began to put on very interesting weekend courses just for the day. And then gradually, I'm not sure at what stage, possibly, it'll be in the archives somewhere. I would say in about 1978 or so, they dropped English as a second language because the students wanted to be in Cheltenham. You know, the last bus in, back from Cheltenham was at 7:30 or something. There was also, it was getting a bit edgy, people in the local pubs were sort of wanting them to pass drugs in and out of Europe. And the time was coming to change, and Bernard and Eileen had got such ideas, and they just took off like that. And some of the courses they put on were so interesting. Very broad, reflecting his intellect, her art, but what was needed at the time. And then they infilled with the education department, the local education authority in Gloucester would put conferences here. And when they got really stuck, they'd have B&A, I think that's the cigarette tobacco company. Well, he smoked, so he couldn't say anything about it. But I mean, the finances came up. Eileen died in the summer of 1977. I was with her at that time of death. And he immediately asked me if I would come on to the trustees. And I stayed for 27 years. Far too long. I shouldn't have stayed that long. But I'd like just for a moment to talk about, I'm not sure that tension is the word, but you had, it was founded by anthroposophists, many German speaking, you know, with this strong, because of what they'd been through in Europe, quite, they'd come to the UK, they'd set up Winston School, which was very popular because a lot of people, you know, had moved into the Cotswold area or this area to bring their children and safer, and there were people coming in from other parts of Europe. So you have Mrs. Wincop, who's interested, Margaret Bunnell, who's deeply involved. Then as they pass, Benedict, who had taught at Winston's, with quite a broad educational spectrum, holding the fort with this other lady. And then Bernard coming in. And one of the first things he said to me was, I'm not a deep purple anthroposophist. I've got very broad interests. And he had, and one of his great friends was George Trevelyan. Now George, as you probably read, George, you know, came from the Trevelyan families from Northumberland. George had been in the army during the war and had been saddened to see how many good men had underachieved in secondary education, for one reason or another, poverty, illness, or just lack of opportunity. And he worked in the Army Educational Unit, and as well as doing the basics that he was supposed to teach, brought in other aspects and found that people thrived, you know. And so he was terribly keen on adult education, and that's why he'd gone to Attingham Park and ran an adult education thing unit that was like any other, because not like any other, because he just knew all these people, so he could invite people in, you know. And we had people who, I'm trying to think of Jonathan Porritt and people like that, who were terribly young, almost students, but had got a message, and George felt we should have them. You know, links with John Elliott Gardner, people from the Architectural Review in London. I just can't remember their names now.
Yeah.
But so George has doing fantastic stuff at Attingham, and Bernard wanted to do, he said, I won't be doing the same as Attingham, but I'll be doing a fusion really between the old and the new. And he managed to do that quite successfully. And I do remember occasionally going into the sitting room, and there'd be a sort of huddle of people speaking German, and you just didn't feel you wanted to infiltrate it, you know. You respected them because they needed to hang on to that bit of their culture. In terms of Stroud, Stroud looked on it as being a bit odd, I think. You know, people that I've got to know in... they thought it was a bit German-based, slightly kinky religion. One or two of the Anglican priests, not all, had looked on it with great hostility. You know, Steinerism and, you know, keep out of that. So I was a bit suspect when I sort of went waltzing into the churches in Stroud, you know. And I said, oh, no, I'm quite happy to take on board elements from both.
Yes.
And it's fine now, they've accepted me, but I was relatively new then, so yeah. They were looking at me with slight sort of, not exactly hostility, but
yes,
but it wasn't the same with all the clergy. I mean, some were, and at the time of Eileen's death, the vicar or rector of Stroud came up every night and prayed with us, and he had a healing ministry. I mean, it was something that he was involved in, and having healing services, but there were others who were more limited. So Eileen died, and Bernard used to come up here for his baths because he was so frightened he'd have another heart attack. I thought he was a bit of a responsibility, really. So after Eileen's death, I joined the trustees, and it was quite interesting because he had George Trevelyan. The former senior post of somebody in the borough of Ealing. I can't remember what it was, but, you know, in local government.
Yeah.
I think he was the treasurer or something. George Turner, a very well-established lawyer from Gloucester area, who'd helped to set up Winston's school. Rhoda Cowan. And Rhoda and Cowan and John and George Trevelyan had been buddies when they were teenagers. So there was a link there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Rhoda and I were the enfant terrible because she was a lot older than me, but we kept coming up with bright ideas.
Oh, great.
We'd sit next to each other. And the meetings were very interesting because, you know, especially as the years passed, because George Trevelyan would come and we'd get through the agenda, and halfway through he'd put his hands on his table and his chin would drop on his chest and he'd be asleep. And you know, we'd try to move the agenda along, and if there's anything terribly vital, we'd sort of... But quite often, we'd be discussing something and he'd suddenly put his head up and come up with something that was so succinct, so relevant, and we just wondered how it had infiltrated his brain, because he did appear to be absolutely asleep. And Rhoda would sort of look at him a bit, you know, and say, George? But it was a very happy trusteeship, really, but difficult. 6 months after Eileen's death, Bernard married Ruth Cookson. Now, George Trevelyan had been at Attingham as the warden, it was first called, and then the principal. Because he had rather what were considered high-flying conferences and Rolls Royces in the adult in the summer schools, which after all was being subsidised by the local education authority, you know, they thought he was pushing it a bit. And the building that he was in was lovely, Attingham Park. It was still lived in by Lady Jersey, who lived in one part, but I think the National Trust owned it but let the college use it for a bit, and I think they were beginning to think they needed it too. So Attingham closed, and George, with the help of his secretary, his devoted secretary, Ruth Bell, had set up the Rekin Trust, which you may have heard of, and they mounted very good conferences all around the country, which was very much in tune with the 60s and New Age thinking, and really, really, you know, very, very exciting, really. And of course, Eileen and Ruth had known each other, as I had. I'd known both of them quite well. And Bernard and Eileen died in June, and at the beginning of December, Bernard and Ruth married. She'd never been married before. She was wife number three. And she'd been the most devoted PA to George Trevelyan. She'd got all these skills of having been the administrator. Well, there was an administrator, but George's PA at Attingham. She brought all those skills to Hawkwood and ran the place very smoothly, and also was very supportive of Bernard and got him to finish his PhD. I mean, she was very organised, very regular, very kind.
Yeah.
And her mother came to live with them too. So he'd had his three marriages, the early one with the children, the very creative period with Eileen, and then the very productive period with Ruth, really, who's only just died. And he died about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. Oh. He was in a home for, I'd say, 5 years.
Yeah.
Because Ruth had always had poor health, and she just couldn't look after him. So he was in Stonehouse, but he had lots of visitors. And on one occasion, there was a young, well, he seemed young, he was middle-aged probably, German who appeared at Hawkwood, and they rang me up and said, is Bernard still alive? And I said, yes, he's alive, he's in a care home. And they said, somebody who'd love to see him, do you think he could manage? And I said, if it's someone speaking German, he'll manage. So I took this chap, I can't remember his name, to the home, and Bernard's son, Christian, and Christian's wife, they were sitting there. And they were so nice, you know. And, this chap introduced himself from wherever he was and started speaking German. Well, the rest of us didn't need to be there. Sort of Christian and his wife disappeared, and I was the chauffeur, so I sat. And, you know, Bernard suddenly switched into German. He was laughing. Periodically, he'd stop and say something in English so that I didn't feel missed out. And he was talking about the history and things that were published in 1930 so-and-so. And wasn't that interesting? And then he'd get a bit sleepy and doze off for a bit, and then he'd come back sharp as a tack. So I wanted you to get the feeling, yes, of Bernard. He wanted to, I think he went a little earlier than he meant to. I think he was, I'm not sure how many years he was there, but I think he was looking for a neat ending, you know, so many years that he would have been there. And he wasn't well. I think Most mother had been ill and had to go into a home, and Ruth wasn't in very good health. And they appointed someone, a friend whom they'd known, Tony. Tony was an architect who'd had Steiner connections, terribly creative, and a wife who was an artist and came from an artistic background, lovely sense. She got lovely paintings and things that she put up. Some of them were quite classical and lovely. And Tony felt it was a time for new beginnings. Bernard had built up from nothing quite a strong bank balance, doing as the architect's son, you know, doing bits as he went along and so on and so forth, supervising it too. Tony came in with quite a lot of flair. If we could do this, we could do that, we could do the other. He changed buildings around a bit. Ruth and Bernard eventually moved out of the big house and had moved into a relatively small flat in the stable block.
Yeah.
So the craft room that I used to have then became her mother's sort of tiny little apartment on. Bernard revamped the whole area and put in quite a nice apartment there, quite a nice flat. He also had ideas of turning Hawkwood into something of a community, so that it was a more productive farm that he would, not perhaps let, but that he would be involved in, and that everybody working there would be part of a community. And he had, I don't think flamboyance is the right word to use, ideas particularly for making it a community, and also for redecorating, reusing rooms and things, and bringing in all sorts of different short courses. They were interesting, and it became a conference centre, whereas if you wanted a centre to put on your activity, whereas of course Bernard and Ruth had been able to provide so many of their own in terms of art history or musical appreciation and things like that. So they'd done a lot of input, whereas Tony was rather more of an administrator, looking after the building, the estate, and bringing in other groups to use it. But the situation was difficult, and the financial reserves were eroded relatively quickly, and the Charity Commission was involved and supported the trustees. Tony moved on. Our chair at that time was Jenny Daisley, who I think was given the award of Businesswoman, European Businesswoman of the Year.
Marvellous.
She was very sharp, very sharp. Rhoda and I at this time were getting a bit elderly, you know, and we were wondering if we should go, but she asked us to stay on board. And we were very aware that the times were changing, because there'd been Margaret Bunnell supporting Lily Winthrop. Then there'd been Eileen and Ruth doing a fantastic job with Bernard. And Tony's wife, whose name I'm sorry, it eludes me, she'd been so supportive of her husband and very thoughtful, you know, and had put a lot in, and had had family of her own, teenagers or youngsters in the 20s. So the trustees felt that it wasn't really fair to appoint a couple and expect one of the spouse, whether it was male or female, to you know, take on the deputy role, really, as they had quite willingly earlier. So we appointed two. Richard Brenson, with whom Katie worked, and Bill Boyd. Bill was an anthroposophist. I think he'd been a priest in the Christian community. But he'd certainly worked at Camp Hill in Yorkshire, and he'd worked in Denver. He'd had an experience in Denver in the States, which I know he'd found magical and really enjoyed it. Quite a deep thinker, short fuse, very nice wife, and it was a second family for him. So he had a grown-up family and then a younger family living in the stable block. Richard was an American, had worked, I think, in a Steiner school in the south of England, bilingual. He'd worked in a sanatorium in Switzerland or Austria, and his wife was Swiss, and he had a young family and lived locally. We felt they brought together those skills that complemented each other. So we had Richard, who'd come from the States, and Bill, who was a Scot, and they worked together for a while. And then Bill decided to go with his young family back to Scotland, and Richard became the principal with various helps. And Katie Lloyd, as she was then, joined the staff and brought in an absolute breath of fresh air, because she'd been at Findhorn and she'd got all sorts of ideas and she'd worked with young people and she'd had the advantage of working in the States and publishing. So she'd got a very well-rounded curriculum, and she and Richard got on extremely well. So after Bernard Nesfield Cookson had left, the establishment had changed somewhat. It became a conference centre. Principals didn't really put on courses that they generated themselves, but invited in. We had some wonderful artists, musicians, interesting talks. And during this time, Richard was very good. He, in Bernard's time, the pastures had just been used really for ponies, people with ponies for pastures, and the woods had been just sort of left, really, tidied up. And Richard brought in a biodynamic gardener, Bernard, who's still with them. They brought in the water feature, and they began to use the soil to work with the agricultural group to use and put up the polytunnels and use to use the land profitably, not only in financial terms but in terms of output.
Yeah.
And during Richard's time, he began to establish open days to which people were welcomed. So they demonstrated what Hawkwood did, the various courses. There would be people in the main hall showing that they were doing embroidery. Lovely Japanese embroidery group that had started, I think, in Bernard's day. People using gong therapy. It was very broad, very wide. In the garden, there'd be maypole dancing for children and all sorts of snacks. And people in Stroud began to realise it was a nice place to drop into, even if you just dropped in on the open days, but that there were things going on there that they would find interesting. And Katie would list in the local paper things that were going on that would be of interest to the local public. And it was a great time of flowering. A period of building on Bernard's work, really. The time came when Hawkwood entered into a new sort of phase, really. Richard moved on, and the trustees were looking, I was no longer a trustee, the trustees were looking for somebody who could grow Hawkwood to its potential. And they had evolved to Hawkwood being a centre for future thinking. And so Alicia Carey was appointed. Alicia has made the most wonderful impact because using her experience at Dartington, she's been very positive. She relates well to the local community. She works well to the local farmers. She's brought in artists in residence, which is a lovely concept. And for Hawkwood to be recognised, I think, both for intellectual and artistic input, but it's accessible to the public. And I think that the tensions that perhaps existed between the founders and the Anthroposophical Society have been diluted, and both groups can find something there that's of merit for them.